This is Audible.
Hachette Audio presents Shrill, Notes from a Loud Woman, written and read by Lindy West. Dedication for Dad. Lady Cluck. Why is "what do you want to be when you grow up" the go-to small talk we make with children? Hello, child. As I have run out of compliments to pay you on your doodling, can you tell me what sort of niche you plan to carve out for yourself in the howling existential morass of uncertainty known as the future? Also, has anyone given you a heads up that everyone you love will die someday? That's like waking a dog up with an air horn and telling it that it's president now. I don't know, Uncle Jeff, I'm still kind of working on figuring out how to handle these weird popsicles with the two sticks. There was a time, I'm told, when I was very small, that I had a ready response to the question. The answer was ballerina, or for a minute, veterinarian, as I had been erroneously led to believe that veterinarian was the grown-up term for professional animal petter. I would later learn, crestfallen and appalled, that it's more a term for touching poo all the time featuring intermittent cat murder, so the plan was abandoned. The fact that any kid wants to be a veterinarian is bananas, by the way. Whoever does veterinary medicine's PR among preschool-aged children should be working in the fucking White House. That period, when I was wholly myself, effortlessly certain, my identity still undistorted by the magnetic fields of culture, was so long ago that it's beyond readily accessible memory. I do not recall being that person. For as long as I can recall, any time I met a new adult who would inevitably get nervous because what is a child and how do you talk to it, and fumble for that same hacky stock question, my imagination would come up empty. Doctor? Too gross. Fireman? Too hard. Princess? Those are fictional, right? Astronaut? LOL. While we're interrogating childhood cliches, who decided that astronaut would be a great dream job for a kid? It's like 97% math, 1% breathing some Russian dude's farts, 1% dying, and 1% eating awesome powdered ice cream. If you're the very luckiest kind of astronaut ever, your big payoff is that you get to visit a barren, airless wasteland for 5 minutes, do some more math, and then go home. Ice cream, not guaranteed. Anyway, loophole. I can already buy astronaut ice cream at the Science Center. No math or dying required. Lindy 1. Astronauts, nada. Unless you get points for debilitating low bone density, in which case, I concede. Not that it mattered anyway. Astronaut was never on the table. Good luck convincing a fat kid that they should pursue a career in floating. Thanks to a glut of cultural messaging, I knew very clearly what I was not. Small, thin, pretty, girlish, normal, weightless, Winona Ryder. But there was precious little media telling me what I was, what I could be. For me, what do you want to be when you grow up was subsumed by a far more pressing question, what are you? I'd squint into the future and come up blank. What do you want to be when you grow up? I can't tell. Static? A snowfield? A bedsheet? Sour cream? Is sour cream a job? As a kid, I never saw anyone remotely like myself on TV, or in the movies, or in video games, or at the children's theater, or in books, or anywhere at all in my field of vision. There simply were no young, funny, capable, strong, good, fat girls. A fat man can be Tony Soprano. He can be Dan from Roseanne, still my number one celeb crush. He can be John Candy, funny, without being a human sight gag. But fat women were sexless mothers, pathetic punchlines, or gruesome villains. Don't believe me? It's cool. I wrote it down. Here is a complete list of fat female role models available in my youth. Lady Cluck. Lady Cluck was a loud, fat chicken woman who took care of Maid Marian, and presumably may have wet-nursed her with chicken milk, in Disney's Robin Hood. Cluck was so fat, in fact, that she was nearly the size of an adult male bear. Being a 400-pound chicken, she wasn't afraid to throw down in a fight with a lion and a gay snake, even though the lion was her boss, hashtag lean in, And she had Monstro jugs, but in a maternal, sexless way, which is a total ripoff. Like, she doesn't even get to have a plus-size fuckfest with Baloo. Footnote 1. Gay Snake felt kind of weird, so I texted my friend Guy Branum. Me. Is it problematic to refer to Sir Hiss as a gay snake? Guy. He's super gay. He exists in the tradition of insidious gay dandies. Me. That's still fucked up, though. Is Prince John gay? Wait, is Jafar gay? Guy. Jafar is super gay. Prince John is effete and incompetent. Scar is gay. Me. Those are all the exact same character! They even have the same voice! Disney is the worst. Guy. Pop culture is the worst. Disney only uses character tropes we've seen before. We gays are unnatural and preoccupied with power. A common theme here is conniving outsiders trying to steal the game, manipulate the system to gain power or protection the non-noble way. Grima Wormtongue, all Jews, gays, women who gossip or do anything but be pretty and passive. Me. I'm so grossed out by how aggressively Disney trains children to defend traditional straight alpha male authority. Guy. It's changing. Me. We are fun at parties. Footnote 2. I know that this bear's name is technically Little John, but Little John is clearly a character being played by a bear actor named Baloo, who also played himself in The Jungle Book and, decades later, yet seemingly unaged, in Tailspin. Subtheory, Baloo is the 13th Doctor. I'm calling the bear Baloo, and this conversation is over. It's weird that motherhood is coded as sexless, by the way. I know most of America is clueless about the female reproductive system, but if there's one thing that most babies have in common, it's that your dad goofed in your mom. Baloo dressed as a sexy fortune teller. In order to assist Robin Hood in ripping off Prince John's bejeweled decadence caravan, Baloo adorns himself with scarves and rags and golden bangles and whirls around like an impish shirocco, utterly beguiling PJ's guard rhinos and incapacitating them with boners. Baloo, dressed as a sexy fortune teller, luxuriates in every curve of his huge, sensuous bear butt. Self-consciousness is not in his vocabulary. He knows he looks good. The most depressing thing I realized while making this list is that Baloo dressed as a sexy fortune teller is the single most positive role model of my youth. The Queen of Hearts. I do not even know this bitch's deal. In Alice in Wonderland, her only personality trait is likes the color red. She doesn't seem to do any governing aside from executing minors for losing at croquet, and she is married to a 1-foot-tall baby with a mustache. She is, now that I think about it, the perfect feminazi caricature. Fat, loud, irrational, violent, overbearing, constantly hitting a hedgehog with a flamingo. Oh shit, she taught me everything I know. That sexual tree from The Last Unicorn. This fine lady was just minding her biz, being a big purple tree, when Schmendrick the garbage sorcerer came along and accidentally witchy-pooed her into a libidinous granny. Then he's all mad when she nearly smothers him to death twixt her massive oaken cans. Hey man, if you didn't want to get motorboated to death by a fat tree, you should have picked something thinner and hotter to transform into your girlfriend, like a spaghetti noodle or clarinet. The sex tree that launched 1,000 confusing fetishes taught me that fat women's sexuality isn't just ludicrous, it's also suffocating, disgusting, and squelchy. Miss Piggy. I am deeply torn on Piggy. For a lot of fat women, Piggy is it. She is powerful and uncompromising, assertive in her sexuality, and wholly self-possessed, with an ostentatious glamour usually denied anyone over a size 4. Her being a literal pig affords fat fans the opportunity to reclaim that barb with defiant irony. She invented glorifying obesity. But also, you guys, Miss Piggy is kind of a rapist? Maybe if you love Kermie so much, you should respect his bodily autonomy. The dude is physically running away from you. Marla Hooch. A League of Their Own is a classic family comedy that mines the age-old question, what if women could do things? Specifically, the women of A League of Their Own are doing baseball, and Marla Hooch is the most baseball-doingest woman of them all. She can hit homies and run bases and throw the ball far, all while maintaining a positive attitude and dodging jets of Tom Hanks's hot urine. The only problem is that she is not max bangable like all of the other baseball women. She has a jukebox-like body and makes turtle face anytime she's addressed, which, if you think about it, makes her not that good at baseball after all. Fortunately, at the end, she meets a man who is also a jukebox turtle face, and they get married in a condescending-ass ceremony that's like, "Aw, look, the uglies thinks it's people." Presumably they also like each other's personality. What? Doesn't matter? Quarantine the less attractive? Kay. The thing about Marla Hooch is that the actress who plays her is just a totally nice-looking regular woman. I always think of this thing Rachel Dratch said in her memoir. Quote, "I am offered solely the parts that I like to refer to as the unfuckables. In reality, if you saw me walking down the street, you wouldn't point at me and recoil and throw up and hide behind a shrub." Hollywood's beauty standards are so wacko that they trick you into thinking anyone who isn't Gina Davis is literally a toilet. The neighbor with the arm flab from The Adventures of Pete and Pete. Big Pete and Little Pete spent an entire episode fixated on the jiggling of an elderly neighbor's arm fat. Next, I didn't wear a tank top for 20 years. Ursula the Sea Witch. The whole thing with Ariel's voice and Prince Ambien overdose is just an act of civil disobedience. What Ursula really wants is to bring down the regime of King Triton so she and her eel bros don't have to live in a dank hole tending their garden of misery slime for the rest of their lives. It's the same thing with the Lion King. Why should the hyenas have a shitty life? History is written by the victors, so forgive me if I don't trust some P90X Sea King's smear campaign against the radical fatty in the next grotto. Footnote. I have some questions about King Triton. Specifically, King, why are you elderly but with the body of a teenage beastmaster? How do you maintain those monster pecs? Do they have endocrinologists under the sea? Because I am scheduling you some blood work. While we're on the subject, a question for the world at large. What is the point of sexualizing a fish person? It's not like you could really have sex with King Triton because fish penis. I don't think fish even have penises anyway. Don't they just have, like, floppy anal fins that squirt out ambient sperms in the hope that ladyfishes will swim through their oops cloud? Is that really what you want from your lovemaking, ladies? To inadvertently swim through a miasma of fin jizz and then call it a night? A merman is only a hottie with a naughty body if you are half attracted to fish. In conclusion, it's a fucking fish man trying to drag you to the ocean floor where it plans to use your dead body sexually! Kill it! It has a fork! Morla the Aged One from The Neverending Story. A depressed turtle who's so fat and dirty, people literally get her confused with a mountain. Auntie Shrew. I guess it's forgivable that one of the secondary antagonists of The Secret of Nim is a shrieking shrew of a woman who is also a literal shrew named Auntie Shrew, because the hero of the movie is also a lady and she is strong and brave. But like, seriously? Auntie Shrew? Thanks for giving her a pinwheel of snaggle fangs to go with the cornucopia of misogynist stereotypes she calls a personality. Mrs. Potts. Question. How come when they turn back into humans at the end of Beauty and the Beast, Chip is a 4-year-old boy, but his mother, Mrs. Potts, is like 107? Perhaps you're thinking, Lindy, you are remembering it wrong. That kindly white-haired snowman-shaped Mrs. Doubtfire situation must be Chip's grandmother. Not so, champ. She's his mom. Look it up. She gave birth to him 4 years ago. Also, where the hell is Chip's dad? Could you imagine being a 103-year-old single mom? As soon as you become a mother, apparently, you are instantly interchangeable with the oldest woman in the world and or 16 ounces of boiling brown water with a hat on it. Take a sec and contrast Mrs. Potts' literally spherical body with the cut diamond abs of King Triton, father of seven. The Trunchbull from Matilda. Sure. The Trunchbull is a bitter, intractable, sadistic she-monster who doesn't even feel a shred of fat solidarity with Bruce Bogtrotter. Seriously, Trunch? But can you imagine being the Trunchbull and growing up with Miss Effing Honey? The world is not kind to big, ugly women. Sometimes bitterness is the only defense. And that's it. Taken in aggregate, here's what I learned in my childhood about my personal and professional potential. I could not claim any sexual agency unless I forced myself upon a genteel frog, or unless, as part of a jewel caper, I was trying to seduce a base, horny fool, such as a working-class rhinoceros. And if I insisted on broadcasting my sexuality anyway, I would be exiled to a sea cave to live eternally in a dank garden of worms, hoping that a gullible hot chick might come along once in a while so I could grift her out of her sexy voice. Even in those rare scenarios, my sexuality would still be a joke, an oddity, or a menace. I could potentially find chaste, comical romance, provided I located a chubby simpleton who looked suspiciously like myself without a hair bow, and the rest of humanity would breathe a secret sigh of relief that the two of us were removing ourselves from the broader gene pool. Or I could succumb to the lifetime of grinding pain and resentment and transform into a hideous beast who makes herself feel better by locking helpless children in the knife closet. Mother or monster? Okay, little girl, choose. Bones. I've always been a great big person. In the months after I was born, the doctor was so alarmed by the circumference of my head that she insisted my parents bring me back over and over to be weighed and measured and held up for scrutiny next to the normal babies. My head was off the charts, she said. Science, literally, had not produced a chart expansive enough to account for my monster dome. Off the charts became a West family joke over the years. I always deflected, saying it was because of my giant brain, but I absorbed the message nonetheless. I was too big, from birth. Abnormally big. Medical anomaly big. Unchartably big. There were people-sized people, and then there was me. So what do you do when you're too big? In a world where bigness is cast not only as aesthetically objectionable, but also as a moral failing. You fold yourself up like origami. You make yourself smaller in other ways. You take up less space with your personality, since you can't with your body. You diet. You starve. You run till you taste blood in your throat. You count out your almonds. You try to buy back your humanity with pounds of flesh. I got good at being small early on, socially if not physically. In public, until I was 8, I would speak only to my mother, and even then, only in whispers, pressing my face into her leg. I retreated into fantasy novels, movies, computer games, and eventually comedy, places where I could feel safe, assume any personality, fit into any space. I preferred tracing to drawing. Drawing was too bold an act of creation, too presumptuous. In 3rd grade, I was at a birthday party with a bunch of friends, playing in the backyard, and someone suggested we line up in 2 groups, the girls who were over 100 pounds and the girls who were still under. There were only 2 of us in the fat group. We all looked at each other, not sure what to do next. No one was quite sophisticated enough to make a value judgment based on size yet, but we knew it meant something. My dad was friends with Bob Dureau, an old jazz guy who wrote all the songs for Multiplication Rock, Schoolhouse Rock's math-themed sibling. He's that breezy, froggy voice on Three is a Magic Number. You'd recognize it. Bob signed a vinyl copy of Multiplication Rock for me when I was 2 or 3 years old. "Dear Lindy," it said, "get big." I hid that record as a teenager, afraid that people would see the inscription and think, she took that a little too seriously. I dislike big as a euphemism, maybe because it's the one chosen most often by people who mean well, who love me and are trying to be gentle with my feelings. I don't want the people who love me to avoid the reality of my body. I don't want them to feel uncomfortable with its size and shape, to tacitly endorse the idea that fat is shameful, to pretend that I'm something I'm not, out of deference to a system that hates me. I don't want to be gentled, like I'm something wild and alarming. If I'm going to be wild and alarming, I'll do it on my terms. I don't want them to think that I need a euphemism at all. Big is a word we use to cajole a child. Be a big girl. Act like the big kids. Having it applied to you as an adult is a cloaked reminder of what people really think, of the way we infantilize and desexualize fat people. Desexualization is just another form of sexualization. Telling fat women that they're sexless is still putting women in their sexual place. Fat people are helpless babies enslaved to their most capricious cravings. Fat people do not know what's best for them. Fat people need to be guided and scolded like children. Having that awkward, babyish word dragging on you every day of your life from childhood into maturity. Well, maybe it's no wonder that I prefer hot chocolate to whiskey and substitute Harry Potter audiobooks for therapy. Every cell in my body would rather be fat than big. Grown-ups speak the truth. Please don't forget, I am my body. When my body gets smaller, it is still me. When my body gets bigger, it is still me. There is not a thin woman inside me awaiting excavation. I am one piece. I am also not a uterus riding around in a meat incubator. There is no substantive difference between the repulsive campaign to separate women's bodies from their reproductive systems, perpetuating the lie that abortion and birth control are not healthcare, and the repulsive campaign to convince women that they and their body size are separate, alienated entities. Both say, your body is not yours. Both demand, beg for your humanity. Both insist, your autonomy is conditional. This is why fat is a feminist issue. All my life, people have told me that my body doesn't belong to me. As a teenager, I was walking down the street in Seattle's International District when an old woman rushed up to me and pushed a business card into my hand. The card was covered in characters I couldn't read, but at the bottom it was translated, weight loss, fat burn. I tried to hand it back. Oh, no thank you. But the woman gestured up and down at my body, up and down. Too fat, she said. You call. In my early 20s, I was working a summer job as a cashier at an upscale general store and gift shop, or, as it was known around my house, the Bourgeois Splendor Ceramic Bird Emporium and Money Fire, when a tan, wiry man in his 60s strode up to my register. I remember him looking like the infamous Silver Lake Walking Man, if anyone remembers him, or if Jack LaLanne fucked a tanning bed and a Benjamin Button came out. "Do you want to lose some weight?" he asked, with no introduction. I laughed uncomfortably, hoping he'd go away. Ha-ha. Doesn't everyone? Ha-ha. He pushed a brochure for some smoothie cleanse pyramid scheme over the counter at me. I glanced at it and pushed it back. Oh, no thank you. He pushed it toward me again, more aggressively. Take it. Believe me, you need it. I'm not interested, I insisted. He glared for a moment, then said, so you're fine looking like that and getting the cancer? My ears roared. That's rude, was all I could manage. I was still small then, inside. He laughed and walked out. Over time, the knowledge that I was too big made my life smaller and smaller. I insisted that shoes and accessories were just my thing, because my friends didn't realize that I couldn't shop for clothes at a regular store, and I was too mortified to explain it to them. I backed out of dinner plans if I remembered the restaurant had particularly narrow aisles or rickety chairs. I ordered salad, even if everyone else was having fish and chips. I pretended to hate skiing because my giant men's ski pants made me look like a smokestack, and I was terrified my bulk would tip me off the chairlift. I stayed home as my friends went hiking, biking, sailing, climbing, diving, exploring. I was sure I couldn't keep up, and what if we got into a scrape? They couldn't boost me up a cliff, or lower me down an embankment, or squeeze me through a tight fissure, or hoist me from the hot jaws of a bear. I never revealed a single crush, convinced that the idea of my disgusting body as a sexual being would send people, even people who loved me, into fits of projectile vomiting, or worse, pity. I didn't go swimming for a fucking decade. As I imperceptibly rounded the corner into adulthood, 14, 15, 16, 17, I watched my friends elongate and arch into these effortless, exquisite things. I waited. I remained a stump. I wasn't jealous, exactly. I loved them, but I felt cheated. We each get just a few years to be perfect. That's what I'd been sold. To be young and smooth and decorative and collectible. I was missing my window. I could feel it pulling at my navel, my obsessively hidden, hated navel. And I scrabbled, desperate and frantic. Deep down, in my honest places, I knew it was already gone. I had stretch marks and cellulite long before 20. But they tell you that if you hate yourself hard enough, you can grab just a tail feather or two of perfection. Chasing perfection was your duty and your birthright as a woman, and I would never know what it was like, this thing, this most important thing for girls. I missed it. I failed. I wasn't a woman. You only get one life. I missed it. There's a certain kind of woman. She's graceful. She is slim. Yes, she would like to go kayaking with you. On her frame, angular but soft, a baggy t-shirt is coded as low maintenance, not sloppy. A ponytail is sleek, not tennis ball on top of a mini fridge. Not only can she pull off ugly clothes, like sports sandals or boyfriend jeans, they somehow make her beauty thrum even more clearly. She is thrifted J. Crew. She can put her feet up on a chair and draw her knees to her chest. She can hold an ocean in her clavicle. People go on and on about boobs and butts and teeny waists, but the clavicle is the true benchmark of female desirability. It is a fetish item. Without visible clavicles, you might as well be a meatloaf in the sexual marketplace. And I don't mean meatloaf the person, who has probably gotten laid lots of times, despite the fact that his clavicle is buried so deep as to be mere urban legend, because our culture does not have a creepy sexual fixation on the bones of meaty men. Only women. Show us your bones, they say, if only you were nothing but bones. America's monomaniacal fixation on female thinness isn't a distant abstraction, something to be pulled apart by academics in women's studies classrooms, or leveraged for traffic in shallow, body-positive listicles. Check out these 11 fat chicks who you somehow still kind of want to bang. Number 7 is almost like a regular woman. It is a constant, pervasive taint that warps every single woman's life. And, by extension, it is in the amniotic fluid of every major cultural shift. Women matter. Women are half of us. When you raise every woman to believe that we are insignificant, that we are broken, that we are sick, that the only cure is starvation and restraint and smallness, when you pit women against one another, keep us shackled by shame and hunger, obsessing over our flaws rather than our power and potential, when you leverage all of that to sap our money and our time, that moves the rudder of the world. It steers humanity toward conservatism and walls and the narrow interests of men, and it keeps us adrift in waters where women's safety and humanity are secondary to men's pleasure and convenience. I watched my friends become slender and beautiful. I watched them get picked and wear J. Crew and step into small boats without fear, but I also watched them starve and harm themselves, get lost and sink. They were picked by bad people, people who hurt them on purpose, eroded their confidence, and kept them trapped in an endless chase. The real scam is that being bones isn't enough either. The game is rigged. There is no perfection. I listen to Howard Stern every morning in college. I loved Howard. I still do, though I had to achingly bow out as my feminism solidified. In a certain light, feminism is just the long, slow realization that the stuff you love hates you. When I say I used to listen to Stern, a lot of people look at me like I said I used to eat cat meat. But what they don't understand is that the Howard Stern Show is on the air for hours and hours every day. Yes, there's gleeful, persistent misogyny, but the bulk of it, back when I was a daily obsessive at least, was Howard seeking validation for his neuroses, Robin cackling about her runner's diarrhea, Artie detailing the Leviathan sandwich he'd eaten yesterday in a heroin stupor and then weeping over his debasement. Howard wheedling truth out of cagey celebrities like a surgeon. Howard buoying the news with supernatural comic timing. A Sagrada Familia of inside jokes and references and memories and love and people's lives willingly gutted and splayed open and dissected every day for the sake of good radio. It was magnificent entertainment. It felt like a family. Except, for female listeners, membership in that family came at a price. Howard would do this thing, the thing I think that most non-listeners associate with the show, where hot chicks could turn up at the studio and he would look them over like a fucking horse vet, running his hands over their withers and flanks, inspecting their bite and the sway of their back, honking their massive horse jugs, and tell them in intricate detail what was wrong with their bodies. There was literally always something. If they were 110 pounds, they could stand to be 100. If they were 90, gross. Why'd you do that to your body, sweetie? If they were a C cup, they'd be hotter as a double D. They should stop working out so much. Those legs are too muscular. Their 29-inch waist was subpar. Come back when it's a 26. Then there was me, 225, 40-inch waist. No idea what bra size because I'd never bothered to buy a nice one because who would see it? Frumpy, miserable, cylindrical. The distance between my failure of a body and perfection stretched away beyond the horizon. According to Howard, even girls who were there weren't there. If you want to be a part of this community that you love, I realized, this family that keeps you sane in a shitty, boring world, this million-dollar enterprise that you fund with your consumer clout just as much as male listeners do, you have to participate with a smile in your own disintegration. You have to swallow every day that you are a secondary being whose worth is measured by an arbitrary, impossible standard administered by men. When I was 22, and all I wanted was to blend in, that rejection was crushing and hopeless and lonely. Years later, when I was finally ready to stand out, the realization that the mainstream didn't want me was freeing and galvanizing. It gave me something to fight for. It taught me that women are an army. When I look at photographs of my 22-year-old self, so convinced of her own defectiveness, I see a perfectly normal girl, and I think about aliens. If an alien came to Earth, a gaseous orb or a polyamorous cat person or whatever, it wouldn't even be able to tell the difference between me and Angelina Jolie, let alone rank us by hotness. It'd be like, yeah, so those ones have the under-the-face fat sacks, and the other kind has that dangly pants nose. Fuck, these things are gross. Can't wait to get back to the omnidirectional orgy gardens of Blaxnoid 7. Footnote. This is also the rationale that I use to feel better every time there's a horse meat in your IKEA meatball scandal. You think an alien could tell the difference between a horse and a cow? Please. The perfect body is a lie. I believed in it for a long time, and I let it shape my life and shrink it. My real life, populated by my real body. Don't let fiction tell you what to do. In the omnidirectional orgy gardens of Laxnoid 7, no one cares about your arm flab. Are you there, Margaret? It's me, a person who is not a complete freak. The first time I was informed that my natural body was gross and bad, I was at a friend's house. We were 8 or 9, still young enough to call it playing instead of hanging out, and my friend looked down at my shins, shining with long, iridescent blonde hairs. "Oh," she said, with recently learned disgust, "you don't shave your legs?" I went home and told my mom I needed a razor. I can still see her face. "You know," she said, equal parts pleading and guilt-tripping, "your grandmother never shaved her legs, and I always wished I hadn't either. Her leg hair was so soft, you can't get that back." "Mom, it's fine," I groaned. I'm sure I was short with her. I didn't want to be doing this either. I was never one of those kids who couldn't wait to grow up. Childhood was a solid scam. I had these people who bought and cooked my food, washed and folded all my clothes, gave me Christmas presents, took me on trips, kept the house clean, read out loud to me until I fell asleep, found me fascinating, and spent pretty much all their time constructing a warm, loving, safe bubble around me that gave order and character to life. Now that I'm a grown-up, what do I have to show for it? Audiobooks, taxes, dirty hardwood floors, a messed-up foot, and -$100? A realistic ad campaign for adulthood would never sell. "Do you like candy for dinner? And plantar fasciitis?" Childhood suited me. I was a lucky kid, and my life was simple. It was fun. So I dug in my heels as hard as I could against every portent of growing up, puberty most of all. I was still pretty weirded out from the time my babysitter let me watch Animal House in 4th grade, specifically the part in which a woman apparently extrudes huge wads of white tissue from her chest cavity. Is that what boobs do? And I wasn't entirely sold on having a vagina at that point, so I sure as shit wasn't ready for it to transform into a chocolate fountain, sorry, and turn my pants into a crime scene once a month. What a stupid thing for a vagina to do! And I had to run a terrifying pink knife all over my legs and armpits once a week to get rid of perfectly innocuous little blonde hairs that, as far as I could tell, served no purpose to begin with? Why did I grow them if I just had to scrape them off? Why have a vagina if it was just going to embarrass me? Puberty was a fancy word for your genitals stabbing you in the back. When you're a little kid, everyone talks about your period like it's going to be a party bus to Woo Mountain. It's all romantic metaphors about blossoming gardens and unfurling crotch orchids, and kids buy into it because they don't know what a euphemism is because they're 11. But it's also a profoundly secret thing. a confidence for closed-door meetings between women. Those two contradictory approaches, periods are the best, and we must never, ever speak of them, made me feel like I was the only not-brainwashed one in a culty dystopian novel. Oh, yes, you can't imagine the joy readings in your subjectivity port when the administration gifts you your woman's flow. Speaking of the flow outside of the menarchy bunker will result in deactivation. Girls in the 70s were the cultiest. They couldn't wait to get their periods and incessantly wrote books about it. Oh, I hope I get it today. I just have to bleed stinkily out of my vagina before that cow Francine. The reality, of course, is that when you hit puberty, you don't magically blossom into a woman. You're still the same tiny fool you were at puberty minus one, only now once a month, hot brown blood just glops and glops out of your private area like a broken Slurpee machine. Forever. Or at least until you're inconceivably elderly in an 11-year-old's estimation. But don't worry. To deal, you just have to cork up your hole with this thing that's like a severed toe made out of cotton, and if you don't swap it out often enough, your legs fall off and you die. Or you wear a diaper. Or, if you have a super chunky flow, you do both so you don't get stigmata on your pants in front of hot 8th grade boy I'm still too bashful to mention. Also, your uterus is knives, and you poop a bunch, and you're hormonal, and you get acne. Have fun in 6th grade, Margaret! Personally, I couldn't handle that dark knowledge at all. So before I hit puberty, and let's be honest, for like 15 years afterwards, I treated my reproductive system like it was the nothing from the never-ending story. When you look at it, it's as if you were blind. I mean, I washed the parts and stuff, but I had no use for it, and the only thing I really knew was that it was eventually going to screw me over and ruin this sunny golden childhood biz I had going on. More like vagina. Ugh. If Google had existed when I was 11, my search history would have looked something like this. How much comes out? How many cups come out? How to stop period? Cancel your period. People with no period. Spells to delay period. Magic to stop period. Blood magic. Witchcraft. Witches. The witches. Roald Dahl. New Roald Dahl books. Free Roald Dahl books for kids. Priorities. My mom, probably sensing my anxiety, dragged me to a mother-daughter puberty class called Growing Up Female. 4 hours on a sunny Saturday, trapped in my elementary school library talking about penises and nipples with my mom. Strangely enough, this did not make my eventual pubing-out process less awkward. Footnote. There was a part of Growing Up Female where everyone was supposed to write their most embarrassing questions on little note cards, and the pube instructor would answer them anonymously in front of the class. I don't remember what my question was, but I do remember that when I went up to put it in the pile, I recognized my mom's handwriting on the top card. "Please talk about inverted nipples," it said, succinctly. In the pantheon of worst ways to learn you have one weird nipple, this ranks just above skywriting, but just below Guy Fieri naming a dish after it, Lindy West's Great American Triple Bangin' Weird Nip Diesel Dip. Also, it was a totally unnecessary horror, as my inverted nipple eventually became an extroverted nipple all on its own. It's even considering going to some open mics. Seriously, you should come. I don't want to give you guys TMI, but let's just say that my aunt period blood eventually did come to town. When it arrived, my avoidance was so finely calibrated that I blocked out the memory almost completely. I think, though I don't know for sure, that I was swimming in the ocean near my uncle's house, a wide, shallow inlet where the flats bake in the sun until the tide pours in, and then the hot mud turns the whole bay to bathwater. I can recall quick flashes of confusion and panic, guiltily unspooling toilet paper in an unfamiliar bathroom by that strange, sticky beach. I did not want to talk about it. I avoided talking about it so assiduously that, for years, I invariably failed to tell my menopausal mom when we'd run out of stuffin' corks and diaper nuggets, hashtag copyrighted, forcing her to run to the grocery store at inhumane hours while I squeezed out silent, single tears in the car. If this had been a Roald Dahl book, she would have developed clairvoyance and summoned the pawns by telekinesis and or delivery giant, Thanks for nothing, regular human mom. Footnote. Nothing, except for the unconditional love and support and meticulous care to make sure that I face the world fully informed about my body and reproductive health. I forgive you for not being a real witch. This avoidance and my life reached an all-time nadir one morning when my mom didn't have time to make it to the store and back before work, so I was forced to go to school wearing a menstrual pad belt that had been in our first aid drawer since approximately 1861. If you've never seen one of these things because you haven't been to the Antiquities Museum, it is a literal belt that goes around your waist with two straps that dangle down in your front and back cracks, ice-cold metal clips holding a small throw pillow in place over your shame canyon. I wish I could tell you that I only had to go through that once before I learned my lesson. One time, I noticed that the little waxy strips you peel off the maxi pad adhesive were printed over and over with a slogan, "Kotex understands." In the worst moments, when my period felt like a death, the death of innocence, the death of safety, the harbinger of a world where I was too fat, too weird, too childish, too ungainly, I'd sit hunched over on the toilet and stare at that slogan, and I'd cry, "Kotex understands. Somebody, somewhere, understands." Footnote. Some 47-year-old advertising copywriter in Culver City named Craig understands. Then, each month, once my period was over, I would burrow back into snug denial all over again, pretending my lady parts didn't exist and that nothing would ever, ever come out of them, to the point where the blood would surprise me all over again, every month. 12 years later, I finally said the word period out loud in public. Part of that anxiety came from the fact that, particularly in my youth, I was a hider, a dissociator, a fantasist. It was easier to bury myself in stories than to deal with the fact that the realities of adulthood were barreling down on me. Money and loneliness and self-doubt and death. Part of that anxiety came from the fact that, as a fat kid, I was already on high alert for humiliation at all times. When your body itself is treated like one big meat blooper, you don't open yourself up to unnecessary embarrassment. I was a careful, exacting child. I hoarded my dignity. Even now, I watch where I step. I double fact-check before I publish. I avoid canoes. The most significant source of my adolescent period anxiety was the fact that in America in 2016, and far more so in 1993, acknowledging the completely normal and mundane function of most uteruses is still taboo. The taboo is so strong that it contributes to the widespread stonewalling of women from seats of power, for fear that, as her first act in the White House, Hillary might change President's Day to "Brownie Batter Makes the Boo-Hoos Stop Day." The taboo is strong enough that a dude once broke up with me because a surprise period started while we were having sex, and the sight of it shattered some pornified illusion he had of women as messless pleasure pillows. The taboo is so strong that while we've all seen swimming pools of blood shed in horror movies and action movies, and even on the news, when a woman ran the 2015 London Marathon without a tampon, photos of blood spotting her running gear made the social media rounds to near universal disgust. The blood is the same. The only difference is where it's coming from. The disgust is at women's natural bodies, not at blood itself. We can mention periods obliquely, of course, when we want to delegitimize women's real concerns, dismiss their more inconvenient emotions, and perpetuate the myth that having outie junk instead of innie junk and a male gender identity makes a person an innately more rational and competent human being. But to suggest that having a period isn't an abomination, but is in fact natural and good, or, my God, to actually let people see what period blood looks like? This is going to blow a lot of you guys' minds, but it looks like blood. You might as well suggest replacing the national anthem with Donald Trump harmonizing with an air horn. Yeah, personally, I hate my period and think it's annoying and gross, but it's not more gross than anything else that comes out of a human body. It's not more gross than feces, urine, pus, bile, vomit, or, the grossest bodily fluid of them all, in my mother's professional opinion, phlegm. And yet, we are not horrified every time we go to the bathroom. We do not stigmatize people with stomach flu. The active ingredient in period stigma is misogyny. This is just a wacky idea I had, but maybe it's not a coincidence that in a country where half the population's normal reproductive functions are stigmatized, American uterus and vagina havers are still fighting tooth and nail to have those same reproductive systems fully covered by the health insurance that we pay for. Maybe periods wouldn't be so frightening if we didn't refer to them as red tide or shark week or any other euphemism that evokes neurotoxicity or dismemberment. Maybe if we didn't perpetuate the idea that vaginas are disgusting garbage dumps, government officials wouldn't think of vagina care as literally throwing money away. Maybe if girls felt free to talk about their periods in shouts instead of whispers, as loudly in mixed company as in libraries full of moms, boys wouldn't grow up thinking that vaginas are disgusting and mysterious either. Maybe those parts would seem like things worth taking care of. Maybe women would go to the doctor more. Maybe fewer women would die of cervical and uterine cancer. Maybe everyone would have better sex. Maybe women would finally be considered fully formed human beings instead of off-brand men with defective genitals. Maybe I wouldn't have had to grow up feeling like a strip of wax paper was the only person who understood me. I don't remember how I got over it. Just time, I guess. I just waited. Eventually, I moved from pads to tampons, and eventually I moved from tampons with applicators to the kind of tampons that you just poke up there with your finger, and eventually I was able to ask a female friend for a tampon without dying inside, and eventually I was able to have a tampon fall out of my purse on a crowded bus and not construct an elaborate ruse to frame the woman next to me. And now I'm just a normal adult with a husband she's not afraid to send to the store for OB super pluses. Ta-da! The truth is, my discomfort with my period didn't have anything to do with the thing itself. Though, to any teenage girls listening to this, yes, it is gross. Yes, it hurts. No, it's not the end of the world. Yes, sometimes it gets on your pants. No, nobody will remember. It was just part of the lifelong, pervasive alienation from my body that every woman absorbs to some extent. Your body is never yours. Your body is your enemy. Your body is gross. Your body is wrong. Your body is broken. Your body isn't what men like. Your body is less important than a fetus. Your body should be perfect, or it should be hidden. Yeah, well, my name's Lindy West, and I'm fat, and I bleed out of my hole sometimes. My body is mine now. Kotex understands. How to stop being shy in 18 easy steps. Don't trust anyone who promises you a new life. Pickup artists, lifestyle gurus, pyramid scheme face cream evangelists, Weight Watchers coaches. These people make their living off of your failures. If their products lived up to their promise, they'd be out of a job. That doesn't make the self-help economy inherently sinister or their offerings wholly worthless. It doesn't mean you can't drop 5 pounds by eating Greek yogurt under the nurturing wing of a woman named Tanya. Or lose your virginity thanks to the sage advice of an Uber driver in aviator goggles? Or help your cousin's sister-in-law earn her February bonus while adequately moisturizing your face for $24.99? We are all simply trying to get by, after all. It's just that, sadly, there are no magic bullets. Footnote, except for Lean Cuisine French Bread Pepperoni Pizza, which is an edible poem. Real change is slow, hard, and imperceptible. It resists deconstruction. Likewise, lives don't actually have coherent linear story arcs. But if I had to retroactively tease one essential narrative out of mine, it would be my transformation from a terror-stricken mouse person to an unflappable human vuvuzela. I wasn't shy in a cute, normal way as a kid. I was a full-blown, Mrs. Pigglewiggle, plant radishes in my ears and leave me in the care of an impudent parrot situation. I was clinically shy. Once, in the first grade, I peed my pants in class because I was too scared to ask the teacher if I could go to the bathroom. When the class bully noticed the puddle between my feet, I pointed at a water pitcher on the other side of the room and whispered that it had spilled. Just in one small, discreet pool under my chair. And also on my sock. And also, the pitcher was filled with urine for some reason. Public schools, am I right? Pretty sure he bought it. Just a few decades later, here I am, the Ethel Merman of online fart disclosure. I now get yelled at and made fun of for a living, my two greatest fears rendered utterly toothless, and even better, monetized. Women ask me, "How did you find your voice? How can I find mine?" And I desperately want to help, but the truth is, I don't know. I used to hate myself. Eventually, I didn't anymore. I used to be shy. Eventually, I made my living by talking too much. Every human being is a wet, gassy katamari of triumphs, traumas, scars, coping mechanisms, parental baggage, weird stuff you saw on the internet too young, pressure from your grandma to take over the bodega when what you really want to do is dance, and all the other fertilizer that makes a smear of DNA grow into a fully formed toxic Avenger. Everyone is different, and advice is a game of chance. Why would what changed me change you? How do I know how I changed anyway? And how do you know when you're finished, when you're finally you? How do you clock that moment? Is a pupa a caterpillar or a butterfly? Footnote, rhetorical question, don't you dare answer it. It's flattering to believe that we transform ourselves through a set of personal tangibles, steely resolve and the gentle forbearance of a mysterious young widow who wandered in off the moor. But reality is almost always more mundane. Necessity, luck, boredom, exhaustion, time. Willpower is real, but it needs the right conditions to thrive. I can tell you my specifics, though. I can tell you the stepping stones that I remember along the path from quiet to loud, the moments when I died inside, and then realized that I wasn't actually dead, and then died inside a little bit less the next time, until now, when my wedding photo, with the caption, "Fat as Hell," was on the motherfucking cover of a print newspaper in England where Mr. Darcy could see it, and my only reaction was a self-high five. Maybe, if you follow these steps to the letter, you'll end up here too. Step 1. Shoplift one bean. I was 4 years old, following my mother around the grocery store. She stopped near the bulk dry goods, and I stuck my hand deep into a bin of beans, cool and smooth. I thought the beans were cute, white with black freckles, like maybe you could plant one and grow a Dalmatian. And there were so many of them, one wouldn't be missed. When we got home, I showed my mother my prize. To my surprise, she was mad at me. "It's just one bean," I said. "It's not stealing." What if everyone who came to the grocery store took just one bean? How many beans would the grocery store have left? This was an incomplete story problem. How many beans were in the bin? How many people go to the grocery store?